like to take this opportunity before I get started to thank the elders here for the invitation that they've extended to me to speak to you again. I think as most of us novices, when we get up here, will indicate there's a certain amount of anxiety that goes along with this, but it's also nice to know that you've got the confidence of the rest of the people in the church. I do have to freely admit, though, that after my last 55-minute marathon, I'm surprised of the invitation to try to speak for 10 minutes or less, but I'll do my best to give it a shot. One of the goals that I've set for myself in starting to preach on a regular basis is, at least until I am a little more comfortable with the situation, is to try to stick to subjects that I've got a little expertise in. So for that reason, we're going to go to law school again for a few minutes like we did the last time. I'd like to spend a few minutes discussing with you what we sometimes refer to as the separation between church and state. A lot of times we'll hear people discuss the subject both from the pulpit, on TV. It's one of Pat Robertson's favorite subjects. But I'm surprised at how little some people really know about what that phrase means. It's important to note that the phrase separation of church and state is found nowhere in any constitution. That's not necessarily true. There are a couple state constitutions that do have some similarity of that phrase. But as far as the United States Constitution, that phrase is not found anywhere in the document. What the Constitution of the United States does say about this idea is that, quote, Congress shall make no laws respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's all it says. And of course, over the last 200 years, that phrase, if you will, has come to mean a lot of different things, some of them good, some of them bad, some of them somewhere in between. It's interesting to note that in prior research I've done, I discovered that up until 1947, the religion clause, as we call it, was only interpreted two times up until 1947. Lost count a long time ago of the number of decisions since 1947, but as we all know, that number keeps growing. The best realistic definition of the religion clause in the Constitution that I've ever found actually came from a legal opinion from Justice Black. I'd like to read that to you because I think it gives the best definition of the true meaning of that clause. He said, the establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment means at least this. Neither a state nor the federal government can set up a church. Neither can pass laws which aid one religion, aid all religions, or prefer one religion over another. Neither can force nor influence a person to go to or to remain away from church against his will or force him to profess a belief or disbelief in any religion. No person can be punished for entertaining or professing religious beliefs or disbeliefs, for church attendance or non-attendance. No tax in any amount, large or small, can be levied to support any religious activities or institutions, whatever they may be called, or whatever form they may adopt to teach or practice religion. Now, historically, there have been two schools of thought about what the Establishment Clause really means. The first principle has been called the neutrality principle, and the logic behind the neutrality principle is simply that there would be no aid by the government to religion. In other words, the government would stay neutral. There are other folks that take the position that there should be what we call strict separation. They feel that neutrality is simply not enough because the very act of neutrality itself allows the dominating, or in most cases, the majority group to achieve some dominant benefit. I think on paper at least, the current Supreme Court and state Supreme Courts will say that neutrality is the current state of the law, but oftentimes in interpreting statutes and making their decisions, they will actually go towards a strict separation interpretation. Unfortunately, this has, to some extent, had the result of actually creating or establishing, if you will, obviously in violation of the Constitution, atheism or secularism as a protected religion. In other words, if we take too strong a stance along strict separation lines and try to stay so far out that there's nothing to do with religion in any law, then in a sense you are protecting atheism and secularism. And I believe obviously that's an unfortunate result. There are a few areas in public life and public policy, if you will, that the separation of church and state have become common battlegrounds lately. The first one that I think is the most common is in the areas of how it affects our public schools and our education systems. I'd just like to touch on a couple of those briefly. The original battleground, long before we ever got to talking about school prayer back in the 60s and 70s, the first major battleground was school attendance. There was a time during the 20s, 30s, and even into the 40s where state courts were trying to ban, if you will, private schools or to require attendance in public schools. Now, this came up most often in situations where a state would, in an attempt to do away with home study, for instance, with the Amish groups, they would pass a law requiring the children to go to public school and would bar home study completely. And then there was a time when states with a strong bias towards the Catholic religion was trying to bar private schools completely. Both of those kind of statutes have been found to be in violation of the Establishment Clause based upon the neutrality grounds. Another area where, in the public schools that is, another area where it's been popular to discuss separation of church and state was what we call released time. Released time contemplates children being released from school to attend religious instruction, but to bar that instruction from taking place in public schools. That's not a very common activity anymore with the size of schools, but this was a common activity when the school systems were much smaller and this was a much more rural country. And then, of course, there's been the subject of school prayer itself, and I think that has been a battleground for the last 20 years. In fact, the people in the room that are younger than me probably don't remember, but I can remember ever so slightly praying in public schools. Basically, what the Supreme Court has done in this area is say that the use of officially authorized prayer or Bible reading is not permitted under the neutrality doctrine. The logic there was that the active support of a particular belief or doctrine would raise the danger of an eventual establishment of approved religious views. I think it's important to note here that, again, at least as the original Supreme Court decisions were coming down on this subject, they were dealing with the use of officially authorized prayer, most common in southern states where there was a strong Baptist community. The school boards there were establishing rules that basically said every morning every student in our school system is going to recite this prayer. Or the church, or the teachers will choose selected Bible readings every morning. That's what was struck down, was that selected use and preferred reading. I think over the last few years, over the last decade, I would say, what we are seeing, though, unfortunately, because of those kind of decisions, is individual teachers and school boards going a little overboard. In other words, for instance, not too long ago on TV, I saw Pat Robertson, as he is so often to do, interviewing a family on this subject, and a little later, 9-year-old daughter had been physically forbidden, if you will, from saying a prayer at her desk in the school. I think even the most liberal, if you will, Supreme Court members would say that that was wrong. That's not what was intended by the original Supreme Court decisions. But obviously with threat of lawsuits and legal fees and things like that, we find that teachers and school boards are going a little overboard and putting a little bit of personal fear, if you will, in their decisions and how they're going to instruct or refuse to instruct their students. And I think that's unfortunate. About 5 or 6, maybe 8 years ago, I think a hot area that lawyers were looking at the time of future litigation in this area was the subject of church discipline. Most of you know about 8 to 10 years ago, there was a very famous case over in Oklahoma having to do with the Church of Christ's rights to discipline a member. I don't think that has become quite the hot topic that the lawyers expected. I think that case had its own share of facts that made it a difficult case to have much precedent with. So we have not actually seen any further major litigation as a result of that case. As a summary of other areas, I think, where the idea of church and state is somewhat always in the forefront, has to do with balancing the public good with individual rights. We're seeing these kind of arguments lately, for instance, with the children's medical treatment. As we all know, there are certain religious groups that refuse certain kinds of medical treatment, and the question becomes, does a parent have the right to refuse that kind of treatment for their children? And that's always argued on separation grounds. And also connected to that is the right to die or refuse treatment. Courts have had to address the issue of whether or not an adult especially has the right to refuse treatment and even if necessary die as a result thereof. In closing, let me just say that it's important that when we address the issue of separation of church and state and the Constitution, if you will, that we keep in mind the purpose of the Constitution, at least in the secular ground, was to create equality. It's a popular belief, I think, and I've heard it even in this very room, that every once in a while there are some things where the majority ought to decide what's best for the rest of us. I think that's easy to say when you're in the majority. There are areas of the country, I think, where churches of Christ would fear just such a way to rule. For instance, I know in West Virginia there's a small community where I think it's the Hare Krishnas have set up their national headquarters, and there's a pretty big place down there with a lot of people. I think it's conceivable that in a rural area like that, that the Hare Krishnas could get a majority of people on the school board and then be in a position, if not for the U.S. Constitution, to dictate what's going to be taught in those schools. So there are times when it's not best for the majority to make the decisions, and the fact that the First Amendment to the Constitution gives these religious protections and freedoms is a good indication that this is an area where Congress and the courts have said this is an area where the majority simply can't control. And I'll also point out to you that the Constitution that protects the minority's rights to worship as they see fit is the same Constitution that protects me and the other speakers here tonight from being able to stand here without fear of government interference and allow us to stay here as long as we want and to speak for as long as we want. Thank you for your attention. I know it's not the most interesting subject for some of you and perhaps not the most favorable subject, but I do appreciate your attention. And I'll turn it over to Brother Blackburn.